The Bible, of course, is a book containing words, and the words convey thoughts, but not just thoughts to us. These words convey images, visual images, especially in the prophets. Isaiah says in the beginning of his prophecy, this is the burden that he saw. It was the load, the weight, the blessed weight of God's truth that he was to write down and convey to the people of his day, to the people after his day, and to the church throughout the history of the world. This is a painting on a large canvas, and we're just past the halfway point. And what we've seen is, in recent chapters, a contest drawn out for us between God and the idols. Here, Babylonian idolatry comes into view. We've seen God challenging his own people. Peter says in the New Testament, judgment begins with the house of God, but it doesn't end there. It goes on because he's the God over all the world. He's the maker, so he has the right. He has the authority, and he has the competence, rightly and justly, to judge all things. But he starts with his own people, and we've seen him charge them with the absurdity of their idolatry. You cut down a tree, you cut the wood in half. Half of it you use to cook your meal and warm yourself by. That's fine. That's a good thing to do with natural creational things. We can use them to sustain our lives, bring us comfort. But the other half you fashion into an idol, and you bow down and worship it. And that's the essence of idolatry. It's making something or attempting to make something out of nothing, practically nothing. God, of course, made the world out of nothing. He spoke, and what he spoke came into being. But you see, idol makers try to mimic God, but we have to use some existing material and make it into God, exaggerate it. God says it's a tree. We say, no, no, it's an idol. Well, we've seen God present the absurdity of that to his people in earlier chapters, and in contrast to that, present himself and all that he is and has done and shown himself to be. And that's the big difference between God and the idols. The idols are lifeless. God lives. God has power. And God exercises that power and exercises it for the good of his people. But now we've come to consider, the Lord brings us to consider, God dealing with the idols of the Babylonians, who were going to be around 150 years after Isaiah prophesied and wrote these prophecies, God's instrument of judgment upon his people for their idolatry. But the Babylonians had their own idolatry. And here's how that plays out. Nobody calls their idol an idol. They call it my God, or my hobby, or my passion. But we treat it like a god. It's the most important in our lives, things in our lives. And when push comes to shove and you've got one people trying to subjugate another people, we all pray to our gods, even if it's praying to missile systems to operate and obliterate our enemy. If that's our idol, you know, we're going to want it to work right and deliver us. And if it fails, if it fizzles, and suddenly we're taken over by the other side, they rejoice in their gods. And their god might be an ideology. Something like that. Talk about lifeless and dry and arid. An ideology. And they think, our gods are superior. That's why we won. Well, that's just what the Babylonians did. They came charging into Judah, besieged Jerusalem, carried off the treasuries of the temple, carried off the best of the people of the land, slaughtered the rest, and celebrated their gods. And that's what we have in our chapter for today. Bel and Nebo, two of the gods of the Babylonians. Do they have reason to celebrate? Do these gods even have existence other than in the minds as a construct of the people who seem to devote themselves to these gods? Well, the Isaiah has shown God's people how to view the coming of Cyrus. Not just yet another conqueror. The Babylonians conquered us, carried us away captive into Babylon. Now comes Cyrus, the Medes, the Persians. And he's just going to be a worse conqueror. But God is saying way before it happened, no, he's not. He's going to let you go back to the land, to the promised land. And in history, when Cyrus did defeat the Babylonians, that's just what he did. And that's why God over and over again here says, look, I've told you this before it happened. I've told you this before it happened. Where are the scientists? Where are those who worship science telling you before it happens? Science is always changing. You can't predict like that. Where are the people whose ideology has been, we will conquer the world? Hitler said he would establish a Reich that would last 1,000 years. And it lasted about 8 years. And he ended his days as a cinder in a Berlin bunker. So where are the goods? And that's what God's doing in these chapters about contests. Put up or shut up. Put up or shut up. Where are the goods? Everything God says comes to be. Everything the idols say, or listen closely, because they really don't say anything, but we think we hear them say, do this, do that, invest your time here, invest your energies here, and it'll pay off big time, and you'll live happily ever after. Tear down your barns, put more money in it, and just retire and live happily ever after. Oh, I got to tell you, you've got a blood vessel and your brain is going to burst tonight. Where's your money now? How's it going to help you? That's idolatry, living without God. That's putting our faith in something, bowing down in a sense, in some way, submitting ourselves to an ideology or a material thing or a potency, and thinking that's the way to be successful. That's the way to live. But God is the one who can put up. He produces the goods. Now, Isaiah, having told the people of Israel what to expect from Cyrus, and to their, well, perhaps shock and amazement, but delight, when Cyrus did conquer Babylon, he let the people go. Now imagine that. You're thinking, I really don't know. I don't even know if there is a God sometimes. We all think that. The fool says with confidence there is no God, but everybody wonders, is it really, am I going to die today? And if I am I going to find out it's all been a fairy tale that I've thought up and everybody else has thought up? We all think that. That's okay. We're not saved by our accurate and perfect thoughts. We're saved by God. He's going to show now what the captors of God's people can expect from the coming of Cyrus. And it will show the vanity of the Babylonian gods, because they trusted in those gods. Everybody had a god in those days. Trusted in your gods. Everybody has a god these days. We all sense within us that we need something greater than ourselves to trust in, to stand upon, to depend upon. What's going to happen to the Babylonian gods? Those gods first are named for us, Bel and Nebo. Bel was the supreme Babylonian god. Baal, or Baal as we call him, the god of the Canaanites. Just a different name for Bel, or Bel, a different name for Baal. And even later, the Romans called this god Jupiter. And then also you have the Babylonians' use of that name, changing Daniel's name, for example, Belteshazzar. Bel He took El, which is Jehovah God, out of the name of Daniel and substituted the name of the Babylonian God. Nebo was a lesser god, scholars say Mercury, the god Mercury, god of the Romans, is that same god, or refers to the same god. It has to do with astrology, the heavenly scribe, and so forth. Nebo, Nebuchadnezzar, the name of Nebo was in Nebuchadnezzar's name. The people were naming their kids, or naming their slaves, their conquered slaves, putting the name of their god in there, like a stamp, a tattoo on the wrist of the subjugated Jews, or a mark on a slave you've bought in the slave market. And this is pretty well total subjugation. How are these people going to get out of that? They don't have the power. They don't have the organization. Jews in Babylon certainly didn't, any more than the Jews in Auschwitz could do it. Jews tried in Warsaw, but nobly, but it cost them many lives. How are you going to get out of the grip of these idols? Well, look at the end of them. Look at the end of them, and look at the career of the idols. They're bowed down. Their images are bowed down. Nebo is stooped over. Their images are consigned to the beasts and the cattle. Here's your true devotees. Beasts, this is a convicting thing. Beasts, dogs, you know, take your cross, for example. We don't worship the cross, we worship Christ. But you can feel like that's a holy symbol, can't you? That's a really holy symbol. Give that to a dog and see what he does. He's not going to fall down and worship it. And he's not going to say, "Oh, I feel a new power coming on me." We're not saved by the symbols that people devise to represent Christianity. We're saved by the living Christ. And this is the picture here. These gods have bowed down to these animals because the animals put them in their right place. We walk over you. We're not going to worship you. The things that you carry are burdensome. Now, this is what I mean about the picture here. Isaiah is full of vivid visual transmission. We're seeing, we're made to see through these words. The people who worship their idols bow down. We are bowing down to our idols. Why are you bowing down to those who are going to bow themselves down? Be bowed down, even before animals, by the conquest of Cyrus. And all predicted and planned and purposed and brought into being by God. Why are you bowing down to them? They are consigned to these beasts, and you have to carry them around. You have to animate them. You have to sustain them. They're burdensome, too, costly, heavy, a load for the weary beast. They stoop over. They have bowed down together. Even the two of them together, Baal and Nebo, couldn't. Two gods can't even stand up against one emperor, or who would be emperor, Cyrus. Oh, but behind them, why is that? Behind him is God, the one true king. They could not rescue the burden. They have themselves gone into captivity. What kind of God is it who can be captured and subjugated? What kind of God is that? It's a bad God. We've got to trade up. If we're going to worship a false God, let's get a better God. But wait a minute. Where's the top of the chain? Where is a supreme God? This is people wonder, there's after Charlottesville and all of that, and what's perhaps coming and developing, people are wondering, what is wrong with racism? I mean, we are different. We look and we see that person is black, this person is white. I mean, there are differences. Here's what happens. Differentiation, when we observe it, We, because we're sinners, and unless we're walking with the one true and living God, we will begin to think in terms of ranking. You're different than me. You're a woman. I'm a man. I'm old. You're young. Any kind of differentiation, then who's the God in the picture? Who's the superior one in the picture? And that, by default, would leave the other, the one to be subjugated. And that's a kind of idolatry, because it's making ourselves God. You're not going to get a black person publishing a book saying, we've done extensive research in genetics and we found out that the whites are the superior race. You're just not going to find it working out that way. And you're not going to find somebody white saying, the blacks are superior race. You're just not going to find it, because it always defaults on whatever I happen to be. I'm the superior race. Or I'm the superior gender. And that's idolatry. And you see, this is something that we read and we think, oh, these little characters and these false gods. Those people were so silly in those days. They all worship false gods. Here they are in our day. Same situation, same dynamic. But God is going to take captivity captive itself in Christ. He's done that. He's broken down the nonsense and the dividing wall between Jew and Gentile, male and female, and the races. He's taken captivity captive. These idolatrous, whether they be mental constructs or actual physical constructs, imputed value and exaggeration of the power of money, for example. Money is so fluid today. It changes from minute to minute in its considered worth. But whatever it might be, that has to be supported by hard effort. It's a burden. But we think we have to do it. It's how we secure ourselves. And even that is going to come crashing down. They have gone into captivity. That's the character, their burdens, their grievous to be born. Idolatry is not only costly to make, as we saw earlier, and we see here with the gold being taken, and you're fashioning an idol out of it to worship your false god, but also costly to maintain. It shows that Isaiah shows us that they are born not in a religious pageant to be adored, but they're born away into captivity. That's where it all leads. That's why the word that came to the rich person who tore down his barns and built the bigger barns is called not just tonight your soul is required, but you fool. You fool. Worship cash. And how's that going to save you? They couldn't rescue their threatened worshipers. The Babylonians were carried off into captivity. And where were their gods? Their gods had fallen. Just the way that Dagon, the god of the Philistines, fell over and over and over again before the Ark of the Covenant of the true and living God in the days of Samuel. This helps us realize how universal Isaiah 45:23 is. Isaiah 45:23, where the Lord says, I have sworn by myself, the word has gone forth from my mouth in righteousness and will not turn back, that to me every knee will bow, every tongue will swear. To me every knee will bow. And whether it's voluntary, as we bow in thanksgiving, in gratitude, in love to the Lord who saves us, or whether it's compelled by those who have built their lives, as Jesus said, on the sand instead of on the rock. It'll be compelled in the final day. Nobody in the final day is going to look when Jesus comes back, and as it's described in Peter and in Revelation, with people seeing and running into the caves and mountains and saying to the rocks, fall on us and hide us from him. If he is a myth, These are going to be seen to be a mighty reality then to anybody who thinks he's only a myth. Every tongue, every knee shall bow. And you get these little hints through history. Because God isn't in the business of compelling anybody yet. He'll compel people who have refused him, rejected him, despised his ordinances and his people. He'll have something to do with them, and they won't have any choice or power to resist it. But meanwhile, he shows this is what he does. This is how he does it. He's behind this. And he declares it before it happens, over and over again. Whether it's the Egyptian exodus, or whether it's the return from exile from Babylon, whatever. How about the ultimate? A dead man in a tomb for 3 days. And a few days before that, everybody was very wisely saying, "This is the stupidest person we've ever known. He has run around saying, 'You believe in me, I'll save you.' And there he hangs on the cross. He can't even save himself. 3 days in the tomb. And he came back. No idol is going to do that." In contrast, the Lord is not borne along by anybody. Sometimes we think he is. Sometimes we think he needs our help. We need to speak up and declare the truth of the Lord because people are twisting and distorting everything and they're all getting out of control and so forth. And we need to be zealous about it and make them. We need to argue stridently. We don't. Go and love your neighbor. You think, what's that going to do? Well, that's going to get people's attention, as it did in the ancient world. "Behold," said the world then, "how they love each other," of the Christians. "Behold how they love each other." And that's what built the church. That's how Jesus built his church. On love. Not lording it over others. In contrast, you see, it's the Lord who bears us, his people. Verses 3 and 4. "Listen to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel." Oh, we forgot about them, didn't we? Israel, the house of Israel, the 10 northern tribes, they've been carried off by a couple of hundred years before now and by the Assyrians. But God hasn't forgotten them. And even if they are still dispersed in what used to be Assyria, God says, "You listen too, O house of Israel. You who have been born by me from birth." Who bore this nation? He formed it. But use the image. He goes on saying, "You've been carried from the womb. Even to your old age, I shall be the same." God doesn't age. He doesn't grow weary. He doesn't lose his power, his strength, his wisdom. He doesn't have to take vitamin B12 for his failing memory. He bears us. And it's total social security that works from birth to and through death. We're never alone. He'll never forsake us, never leave us. Never does his son sitting at his right hand in heaven now interceding for us stop that intercession for us. I've borne you. I shall be the same. Even to your graying years, I'll be with you. Gray hair, you're starting to stoop, wrinkled skin. You go sit over there under the tree at the picnic. We're not interested in you. You can't help our volleyball team win. But God's not like that. He stays faithful. "I have done it," he says. I'm not just talking about it. He's done it over and over and over again. He bore Moses until he died. He bore Moses, and when Moses sinned, Moses didn't go out on a strong note. He sinned, and God tenderly let him see the promised land from a distance. And told him, well, you can't go in, but they'll go in. So basically he's saying, well done, good and faithful servant. You've accomplished your mission. That's our God. I've done it. I shall carry you. I shall bear you, and I shall deliver you. Because there are times when we're not just being conveyed. Drive your car. It's bearing you. You're not bearing it. Drive your car. Stop at a light. Somebody comes, puts a pistol in your face. Give me your car. Your car is not going to jump to life and deliver you. You give them the car. But God delivers us. His bearing of us is not just, you know, carrying us from place to place. Carries us through all challenges, all reversals, all apparent defeats, all actual defeats. When we brought the suffering on ourselves the way that Israel and Judah had done by their drifting from the Lord and sinning against the Lord and rebelling against the Lord and despising the Lord. He still carried them through and delivered them. That's God. Well, objection to this. Has he always borne his people? What about the captivity? Surely God threw his people off there. Did he? Question. Who can answer it? Who among the young children can answer this? Did God go into captivity with his people into Babylon? Yes or no? Just shake your head a little bit so I can see. Oh, some of these smart young ladies in the back got the right answer. Yeah, God went into captivity with his people. He didn't just sit in heaven and say, I am ordaining that you go into captivity. And when you get humbled and you're humble and ready to trust me again, I'll be up here in heaven and I'll give some orders and you come back. No, God went into captivity. And how do we know that, children? How can we prove that? Did we ever see God in captivity? Shadrach, Meshach. Who are the others? Where were those guys? Furnace. And where was the furnace? Babylon. I'm a great teacher. Furnace in Babylon. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego put in the furnace because they wouldn't bow down to the image of Nebuchadnezzar. And I mean, he's the big cheese, big god, and part of his name. And in the furnace, even Nebuchadnezzar saw there was one like the Son of Man. He saw God in that with his three believing young men. God went into that captivity. Just like God went into death for us. How do you know you're not going to die if you trust Jesus? Well, we'll bury you someday, those of us who remain, or you'll bury me. We'll go through what looks like the end. Just like when they put Jesus in the tomb, it looked like the end. Everybody thought it was the end. Nobody thought he was going to be raised from the dead. Nobody. Not a single person. The disciples, where were they on the third day? They were all hiding away. They were afraid. Where were the women? Oh, they went to the tomb. What's wrong with that picture? Why would you go? That's what the angel said. Why would you be looking for the living amongst the dead? I mean, their love was fine. That they wanted to go and even loving him as a corpse. Show respect for him. But that's kind of the best you can do when you're in captivity. Jesus broke us out of captivity. And he showed us death can't hold him. Death can't hold us. The Lord delivers his people. Our money won't do it. Our government won't do it. Our racist propaganda won't do it. Only the living God will do it. And our God is incomparable. Again, we see this in verses 5 and following. the captivity that God led his people into, and he did lead them and was with them in it, the captivity was not a defeat of God or a desertion by God of his people. Instead, it was a chastisement of which he faithfully and repeatedly had warned his people, and which he used to purify them once again. And there, you see, when they're actually in it, and they wouldn't be in it if they didn't need to be in it to see God better. Not that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had sinned, but, you know, they needed to be in that furnace to see God. Because they didn't quite see him. And you know how we know that? Because they said, our God can deliver us from that furnace, but even if he doesn't, we're not going to worship that darn image. They didn't quite know and perceive that God would actually, they would see him in the furnace and he would preserve them. So in that captivity, they saw God. And here's what they see. God is helping beforehand. Here's what to look for, he says. Verse 5, to whom would you liken me and make me equal and compare me that we should be alike? God is unique. By definition, God, if he is supreme being, ultimate cause, first cause, creator, whatever you want to call him, there are not many of them. Because how do they sort themselves out? Who is God? Who is the supreme being? Where do the other gods come from? Any way you want to look at it. To whom shall you liken me? Those who lavish gold from the purse and weigh silver on the scales. Here we are making idols again. You have to lift it up on the shoulder and carry it. That's how you have to do every other god. And again, just to think about just finances. You just can't sit around and not tend to your finances. You cannot do it. If you don't keep up with and track the bills and pay them on time and don't overdraw your account and stuff like that, you're going to lose your money. So just maintaining a household, not even getting rich, requires a lot of investment, time and energy. We're carrying, and in this case, if we do it legitimately, we're carrying and caring for the operation of our procurement of our daily bread that we must labor for, as God said, even to Adam. By the sweat of your brow, you gain your bread. But we also pray for it, and we're taught to pray in the Lord's Prayer for our daily bread. But when we make it an idol, it's even more time we have to spend with it. Because you've got to start putting it out in sort of risky investments to get a return better than just paying your bills. And then you start seriously losing sleep, and your health goes to pot. Because you're always worried about your investments. Will they collapse? You've got to read the papers with obsession to see what the markets are doing, so forth. So that's the picture. That's the other gods. That's your gods. Who's like that? Am I like that, says God? Do you see God on the stock exchange? Put your investments in God, the living God. No. They lift it up. They carry it on their shoulders. They set it in its place. It stands there. It doesn't move from its place. Why not? It ain't alive. That's why not. Though one may cry to it, it can't answer. Why not? It can't hear. It's deaf. It can't hear. It can't deliver him from his distress. In contrast to God in verse 4 saying, I shall bear you. I shall deliver you. Remember this, he says, and be assured. Remember this. Now, these are facts. God is exceedingly scientific. He's not saying blind faith. Just trust me because I say to trust me. Our faith is reasonable. Where is the one who made it all and who has shown repeatedly? He doesn't have to take out full-page ads, and he doesn't have to tweet and tell you that he's doing it every day. But this little book contains enough hints and points that anybody who wants to see it can put it together and say, you know, this is a pretty impressive track record, because this book interweaves with history. Some of it is just notions. Like I mentioned this morning, the book of Proverbs. It's commending to us diligence over sloth and moral purity over promiscuity. And it's saying these are wise ways to live. if you want to be a fool and you want to get a venereal disease, or you want to lose all your lose your house because you haven't worked, well, you can do that. But even that interplays with history, because this wisdom vindicates itself by those who actually try and practice it, understand it so they practice it. The basis of all science, the ultimate basis of all science, is the maxim that there are no effects without a cause. The basis of godless science is there are no effects without a cause. And so, without God, let's ask, what is the cause? And we're not asking what is the cause of a certain strange phenomenon. We're asking what is the cause of the whole shooting match. Everything. Everything that's ever been, everything that is, everything that's likely to be hereafter. What's the cause? What does godless science answer, boys and girls? Didn't you read Stephen Hawking on this question? Stephen Hawking says science is the cause. Did you know that? Science is the cause. But wait a minute. You derived your science from saying there's no effect without a cause. But what is the cause? Science is the effect, study of the effects. Well, what is the effect? What is the cause of the effect? The science. Science. You got nothing. And so you've undermined all science. Because you said there's not just a one or two things, but everything, the whole shooting match, has come from nothing. Now this is very, very, Stephen Hawking is brilliant, the best writer of science that I know. And I agree with him. I think he's on to a whole lot. Except he demonstrates this foolishness here. Because really everything did come from nothing. Everything did come from nothing. Until God spoke. The God who has always lived. He spoke. And out of nothing created the heavens and the earth. And has been governing the heavens and the earth. And has entered in not only from time to time with visions and prophecies and predictions and historical miraculous deliverances from a powerful nation in Egypt of his enslaved people, or the same thing in Babylon and coming back. He's come into the world in the person of his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, to deliver us from the bondage that we all suffer. We all suffer. From the domination of sin. And we suffer from shame and fear and guilt. We suffer. And we look for solutions and relief to other things. If nothing else, if I'm not going to positively make a false god, I will demonize my enemies and make them, it's all their fault. Because I've got to somehow get a more secure life. And God says, I'm not like that. And you know I'm not like that. Remember this. Remember this when you come into the furnace of captivity in Babylon, you Jews, which they did. Remember this and be assured. Recall it to mind, you transgressors. Those are his people he's talking to. Remember the former things long past, for I am God and there is no other. The former things long past, not just the Exodus, but back, way back to Moses' account of creation. Where did it all come from? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Our faith is reasonable. Our faith has substance and foundation. It's folly to trust in anything other than God. Declaring the end from the beginning. The end? Yeah. He tells us how it's all going to end. Jesus will come back. He'll come back. There'll be a final judgment. And His people will be perfected in glory to reign with Him forever. God declares that. From ancient times, things that have not been done. Nobody's come back to end the world. It will be on one level, if it weren't so heinous to even think about it. These are surely surrealistic days. On one level, it would be, I don't know the word to use, but if we do have a nuclear exchange, and there are survivors, it would be, at least to me, because I have a foolish mind and goes off in weird directions at times, it would be, at least to me, an interesting thing to see how we survive. What life is like. And I mean, I've been subject to all the apocalyptic literature and the films and stuff like that. It'd be interesting to see if we all were eating other people's arms and things like that to survive. Or if we bounce back relatively easily, the way Japan did after World War II. I personally don't think we have the power to destroy the world. But I could be wrong. But I do know this, that the world is going to end by the one who began it. And the only ones who are going to be prepared for it and thinking about it are the ones who have come into contact with Him, or He's come into contact with us. And we've come to trust Him and believe in Him. My purpose, says the Lord, will be established, and I will accomplish all my good pleasure. And what is that good pleasure? It's to save us from ourselves. Save us from ruining ourselves. Deliver us from what we were born into the world as, sinners, separated from God. Yes, He'll take Cyrus, who might seem like an imposing and ingenious ruler as well as general. But He's a bird of prey. God just summons like that, and He comes to do His will. Man of my purpose from a far country, I have truly spoken. Truly, I will bring it to pass. I, the Lord, have planned it. Surely, I will do it. When you wake up tomorrow and you think, is that getting a cold coming on? Why is my ear aching? I'm feeling my age. Or I think my knee's going out. Am I going to keep my job? Will I get the contract, I hope? All these things that we wonder and worry about. We don't have to live that way. It's all planned. It's all in the hands of our Father. He promises to give us the things we ask for. Does this mean we don't work and we're not diligent? No, He's the one who tells us to work and be diligent. But it's one thing to work while you're spending half your energy with an eye on an idol. Will this save me? Will this secure me? It's another thing to have all your energy focused on the Lord and know that He is enabling you to mount up with wings like an eagle and be more than a conqueror. So he concludes, listen to me, you stubborn-minded. It's not that it's not scientific. It's not that it's not really, truly reasonable to right reason. That we believe in a God. It's not that it's reasonable not to believe in Him as though somebody somewhere discovered He doesn't exist. It's a stubborn mind. That's what makes people think there's no God. Same way when I close my eyes, I say and say truly, I see nobody in this room. You know I'm not lying. I see nobody in this room. And I live like there's nobody because I see nobody. And I go out and just start stumbling over you. But it's all because my eyes are closed. It's not because you're not there. I will bring near my righteousness. It is not far off. Our God comes to save us by His death in Christ. He makes us, as He is, righteous, holy, and loving, and merciful. My salvation will not delay. I will grant salvation in Zion and my glory for Israel. Whatever we think now of how nasty the world and even the church is, we're headed for glory. Thanks be to God, the one true and living God. Amen.